Hi, I'm Rob Kendall, and this is the Front End Podcast.
The Front End Podcast explores the ins and outs of life as a developer. We delve into challenging topics around modern day development and technology, including learning, professional growth, programming languages, frameworks, tools, techniques, UX, UI, careers, and so much more.
Hi there, and welcome to episode 3. On today's show, we're joined by Chris Bertrand, who's a senior developer with Aldmore Bank, dealing with C#, Angular, and a range of other technologies. He's also a freelance web developer at Design Puddle. He's going to be talking to us about linting and static code analysis and other great things you can do to enforce kind of code quality policies. So let's get to it.
Hi, Chris. How's it going?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, very good, sir. Very good myself. Chris is a senior developer with Aldmore Bank, recently of Sage. Sage, that is the same that do the Sage accounting software, but it was Sage People. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about his coding story and kind of how he got into development. And then we'll talk about really technical things, static code analysis and ESLinting, enforcing rules, and how we can, the sort of the pitfalls and good parts and bad parts of all that. So, Chris, senior developer, how long have you been a developer?
So I've been developing for, I think it's like coming up to 12 years. So quite a while now. Yeah.
Quite the veteran. I like it. How did you get into it? And I ask this of a lot of guests because I quite like to know people's kind of coding origin stories. And as I was saying just before we started recording, mine is very linear. I built computers and then I programmed them. So I literally built them and told them what to do. And that's kind of as interesting as my story gets, where everyone else seems to be like, oh, I used to be an Olympic shot putter and then I started doing big data in Python. And it's like this really pendulous swing. So how did you get into it?
My story is a little boring, I guess. I've always been sort of interested in computers from an early age, you know, having a Spectrum and stuff. And then like PCs when the internet was just coming around. I suppose NTL was giving away sort of free broadband. And that was the sort of time when you're jumping on and you had your Napsters and all your fun internet things. I think you're talking about MySpace this week on the podcast.
Yeah, we were talking about, obviously it's another fellow golden era of internet when we had the dial-up and you had to shout at your mum to get off the phone because you go on MSN, you're like, get off the phone, and it used the modem, and it was there, right, horrendous noise for 10 minutes. And then the promise of maybe connecting, maybe not.
With chat rooms don't really exist anymore, do they? But they were interesting.
They were fun, yeah. There's a lot more safety in the randoms on the internet then. I mean, it seems to be a lot more creepy now. Where back then, it was just some random in America you were talking to or someone in the chat room. Who knows? Oh, yeah. So you got into it in the sort of the golden era with the free NTL and stuff. How did you work your way into Sage and then into the bank where you are now?
Yeah, so it was pretty much a straight route. I went through school, straight to university, and then in as a sort of junior web developer, sort of my first role. And then spent a few years doing that and decided that actually I'd go and explore the world a little bit, have a little bit of a travel, get away from computers for a while, and then returned and sort of properly stuck into it and learned the craft, as you'd say.
So that's another thing I mentioned in the very first episode, and it comes up a lot. I get asked whether, and there's a lot of debates on Twitter, and I get asked a lot whether you need a computing science degree or something of that nature. Did you go through that full range of like higher education or things, or did you kind of do similar to what I did, it was a bit of self-taught, then you got like a junior role and just kind of climbed that learning curve?
I did the computer science degree, but it's an interesting topic that whether what you've learned at that course actually teaches you anything business related. It's a good grounding, but in terms of what I did at university to what I'm doing now, there isn't a whole lot of overlap apart from, you know, object oriented design and sort of those bits.
I mean, I haven't come from that background, and it's interesting to meet someone because I've not really talked to many people who have come from that background. So it's nice to hear the other side of it, of like, you've got a computing science degree. How do you find that helps? And I think that's the conclusion that I've come to on my own, is that it will open some doors for you. And I think it will give you more of a grounding in the kind of formal structure of things like object-oriented programming and the solid principles and everything else that you kind of use without knowing maybe what they are. So it would give you that sort of grounding.
But equally, I think you go into education at such a young age that, you know, you're kind of finding yourself as well as trying to find your career. So it, not necessarily know if it's the best time, but I think it's a good time of your life, really. So there's definitely no regrets there.
Well, it's nice to hear, you know, both sides of it. As a senior dev at a bank, then you'd definitely in this fintech, which I'm not going to lie, I first thought was something to do with like tech coming out of Finland. When I very first saw it, I was like, what's all this fintech everyone's doing? Did not know it was financial tech, so I'm going to hold my hands up there. You can still be a senior developer and get that horribly wrong. How do you find life in fintech? What do you kind of get up to as a senior dev in a bank?
All sorts. I guess that whole software life cycle, getting it from early requirements and getting it out there to the customer to use, going from design phase to sort of the DevOps and pushing stuff out and making it as robust. And, you know, there's a lot of regulation in banks, so it's making it secure and doing all those sorts of, I guess you could call boring things, but equally things that make code solid for the end user.
I suppose that's quite an interesting side with the regulations, because normally in a lot of kind of agency environments, or where I am, where we're kind of making our own software up, there's a lot of security implications. I mean, I'm in the security authentication space, but there's not really a lot of regulation around it. So that's must be quite an interesting, maybe interesting or interesting with quotes, addition to just the normal challenges of software development. So yeah, do you find that makes it a bit more difficult, or just adds an extra kind of challenge around it with that kind of regulation?
It definitely makes it more tricky, because you know, software has to be signed off, there's got to be rules, there's got to be reasons for doing it. So playing around with the latest and greatest is always tricky, and they're always a little step behind just to make sure that there's no sort of severe vulnerabilities in the tools that you use.
But the meat and potatoes of what we're here to talk about is exciting tech topics like static code analysis and linting. the normal mortals will go, what is that and why are you excited by it? But us devs, we like our rules and our static code analysis. So for anyone who's not familiar with things like static code analysis or linting, maybe they haven't used it before, could you explain a little bit about what static code analysis is?
Yeah, linting in a nutshell is the name for the process of checking your code against a set of rules. You know, each language is sort of specific. So linting will run a program or a tool that will analyze the code in that language for potential errors. And then it will let you know as a developer if something's, you know, wrong or severely wrong, and then potentially give you options to fix it, or, you know, just let you know.
Why should people care about it? And if they're looking to implement it in their organization, why would that be good for them?
I've been to a few roles and a few companies, and a lot of things, as a new developer, you'll come in and you'll sort of ask, what are our coding standards? You know, what as a developer do we need to follow in this sort of organization? And usually you'll be given a 600 page document with examples of, are you using camel case, Pascal case, Hungarian notation, if you're doing some old .NET stuff. And it's quite difficult, because although you read all the rules, they're not really ever enforced or shown to you while you're doing the code, you know, unless it goes through a code review process, and then someone will say, oh, we do it like this, we do it like that, our brackets are on a different line. I think it's quite a good way to enforce your coding sort of principles or your values in an organization during your development process, rather than sort of after or on an ad hoc basis.
Yeah, it's nice. I mean, I think for me, it comes down to communication. I mean, I'm a big fan of LinkedIn. I must admit, I don't do a lot of configuration. I work in the dirty world of React, and even more dirtier, the kind of Create React app, which kind of is very opinionated and puts a lot of stuff in place for you, like LinkedIn rules. But it's kind of like the best practice one. But I'm a big fan of enabling people to communicate in the same sort of way, because I think ultimately good software development comes down to efficiency and maintainability. And I think if you're all on the same page, and that's enforced with things like linting, that gives you that efficiency and maintainability. Because it's a bit like, I know people like to get very gatekeepy about, ooh, I like my brackets this way, and I like, there's a lot of people get really excited about having their variables in CSS, the properties in like alphabetical order. And, yeah. And that's all fine, but ultimately it comes down to, it's the same way that people get very guardy about grammar, and I'm the biggest grammar Nazi ever. But I think it's important, because it enables you to communicate more effectively with people. You know, if you start sticking commas in the wrong place, or missing them out, or just having your sentences run on with absolutely zero punctuation, it makes it more difficult to communicate. And I think some of that kind of linting is what that comes down to. You know that when you open someone else's file, it's going to be formatted in a particular way that you're familiar and comfortable with, and surely that's got to make it a bit easier for you, right?
Exactly. And especially for, you know, this being a front end podcast, for sort of interpreted languages like JavaScript, you don't necessarily know about problems in your code until you run it. So a linter will sort of tell you those up front. So it kind of gives you a helpful hand as well that, oh, actually, this code might not work, rather than having to go through the process of finding it yourself.
Yeah, sure. Definitely. That is one of that is both the nice thing and the terrible thing about JavaScript, is that it's so free and easy. It's just like, hey, it's like the hippie of languages. Let's just do whatever you want, mate. It's fine. Because we're not strongly typed here. We're not going to, none of that strict police state stuff for here. Just type whatever you like. But you're right, it does introduce potentially more problems and things. So it's nice to have that. If you're not a fan of TypeScript, like I'm not, for whatever reason, I'm not a fan of it. But TypeScript circumvents a few of those things, I think, by trying to be a bit more sort of strongly typed and ape other languages like C#. Without that linting is a good first step, I suppose, to kind of catch those errors.
I've been a Microsoft sort of developer for pretty much my whole career, so moving from C# to TypeScript is a lovely move. But yeah, if you're a JavaScript developer and then having all the types imposed on you, it is a bit of a hurdle usually, I find.
Yeah, I did it that way. I started as a full stack developer in the good old days of like ASP.NET 2. So I came from kind of Visual Basic, then quickly realized no one used that and just switched over to C#, which kind of was very similar. Just you shoved a few more curly braces in there, and everything was kind of the same. And then I kind of just did more JavaScript, but we didn't have things like TypeScript when I kind of did the switch. So to retrofit TypeScript into my workflow is a bit like, well, I already write pretty okay JavaScript. Hopefully, I don't know, my employers will tell you, maybe otherwise, but it works all right. I don't feel the need for that extra thing, but it's quite nice, I suppose, to help pure Microsoft C# veterans, if you like, move into the kind of JavaScript and keep a lot of the familiar language side of it. You know, we've got some good benefits there, but I mean, with most things in development, you've got a trade-off between the benefits and the drawbacks. So what are some of the perhaps the cons to linters or employing some kind of static code analysis policy?
Yeah, so say you've got a massive project already. It's a big application, and you kind of go, okay, I want to introduce it halfway through or right now, and you'll run it once and you'll get potentially sort of thousands of errors or warnings coming up, sometimes as many as there are sort of lines of code. So it can lead to a lot of false positives that sort of may deter you from fixing what is there or what's actually important. And that's why sort of setting up the rules that you sort of believe in and, you know, those sort of fundamentals is sort of crucial.
Have you always worked at somewhere where you've had these kind of linting policies, or have you been instrumental in kind of bringing those into places? I mean, as a senior dev, you'd hope you have a bit more influence, or you're allowed to bring a bit more experience in your wagon with you when you join. Have you kind of rallied everyone to get those things implemented and enforced yourself?
I'm a big fan of sort of process, but in adding process to a team and getting them sort of improving in that way. So I've recently added linting into a sort of big project, and it was a sort of an Angular JS project that sort of then morphed into a Angular 2 plus project with JavaScript and TypeScript and all sorts of stuff. So I think I came across this problem at that time where there were just errors everywhere, and people get really scared because when you come up and they say your code has got like 10,000 issues with it, you know, you kind of want to run a mile. So it's scary, but it's all about the sort of the time it can save you moving forward. I always think if you're going to lint code that you're never going to touch again, then just leave it. It's not necessary. But if you want to be improving this tool, if it's, you know, like software as a service product that you're going to be expanding upon, then adding this in, especially if your team's expanding or there are a sort of number of developers and you want to teach them best practices, you've got some junior developers there, you get everyone onto the sort of same level, understanding what they can and cannot do.
That's quite a nice additional angle, actually, kind of training up maybe less experienced or junior developers by, you know, as bad as it sounds, almost forcing this best, you will write it this way, you know, like the best practice is like forcing it on them, which is quite nice, because I suppose it takes that element of uncertainty away from them if they're sat with a wall of code going, oh, how's the best way to kind of put this in? Where do I put the braces and how do I do if statements and things like this, where if you kind of give them that that subtle, or maybe not so subtle, influence with the quality, that's quite a nice additional benefit.
Yeah, definitely. You know, linting is inexpensive in actual compute time. There isn't, it happens while you're writing it, and you can enforce it in different ways, but it doesn't actually, you know, it doesn't stop the developer doing it. It just sort of nudges them to say, oh, you could do it a different way, or, you know, we could tinker this to do it some newer syntax, or the new null operational chaining and all those things. You can add in those rules to say, structure my code in such a way or in another way, because a new rule has come in or a new property has come in ES, I'm not sure what we're up to now, 20. So I like it. I'm a big fan. I can see the benefits, especially if your team's really big and you don't want a lot of manual time being spent reviewing people's code.
Yeah, definitely. So when you've kind of come along and brought that in, how do you go about introducing that to, so it's one thing taking an organization that already has it maybe in place and you just add to it. But if you've got an organization that has not got any kind of linting policy, how do you go about stuffing that into that organization? Do you kind of just turn it on and go deal with the errors, or do you kind of introduce like a gradual adoption process?
Yeah, so I think the first time I did it, I just said lint the whole code base every time someone does something, and just sort of like a passive approach, so hands off. So say, these are the issues. I'm not saying you have to fix them, but this is what they are. And you sort of monitor that process over a period of time and see, does anyone take any notice? And basically, no, they don't. if at the time you say to someone, this isn't quite right, but I'm not going to stop you, people will kind of just go, okay, well, I won't do anything about it. I sort of find the happy medium is, you know, it's like the Boy Scout rule. When you touch a bit of code or a file, you sort of make it better than when you found it, sort of keep it cleaner than when you found it. You know, I think the sort of happy medium is you only lint or enforce linting on files that you've changed and you're committing or staging. You don't make them fix everything, because that's probably a bit irrational, but you make them fix what they're currently doing.
There's a James Bond title in there, something like, you only lint once, or so, you only lint twice, or something. Something like that. I like that Boy Scout rule. If anyone's wants a key takeaway from this podcast, I would imagine that's really quite good. I wrote an article ages ago about this kind of continuous refactoring, if you like, where, you know, I've worked in places where they're like, right, we're going to have this imaginary time in the future where we're going to refactor everything and everything will be shiny and we'll all sing around, you know, walk around holding hands, and it'll be great. And it's like, it doesn't happen. You don't need to be aggressively, obsessively refactoring, but I think you need to do it as you go along. Or like you said, if you open a file and you can improve it to make some changes, and you can improve it while you're there, whether that's refactoring it or linting it. Yeah, that's probably a really good way to do it. And then I suppose that does eventually, you will eventually expand your lint, the coverage of the linting, if you like. How do you decide on what rules and policies to apply? Because I mean, even if you just go on one linting tool like ESLint, as awesome as that is, there are hundreds of different rules and things that you can apply to it. How do you decide which ones to apply and which ones to not?
Yeah, so there are, I've sort of been doing sort of the Angular side of it. So Angular has a rule set code Codalizer, which is specific to the way Angular sort of templates are written and that. But there are sort of big name companies that have rule sets. So Airbnb is a sort of popular one. Then you've got the sort of React and Shopify that have their own rule sets. And what you kind of do is you take them as a base, and then you extend them to do what's right for your organization. You can write them from scratch yourself. And if you have a document that specifies all of your principles in a nice way, then you could do it yourself. But I'd say using something battle-tested that some companies already use out in the wild is a good way of creating sort of a benchmark or a baseline that you can build upon to do what you need it to do.
And I think it's important to, you know, remember that massive companies like Facebook or Airbnb and things, they don't have all the answers. Yes, they have a lot of really excellent, you know, top-notch people who work for them, but I think it's just the sheer amount of people that work for them and the amount of code they go through, they find the failures quicker. So I think they are a good place to start. Take their, well, how, you know, you're a very successful company pushing out very huge code bases on the regular. Which bits can we kind of learn from your successes, or learn as much from your failures? I like that. It's probably a good place to start. And how do you enforce the policies? Do you do like a combination of in people's IDE, like through say an ESLint config? Do you do it at the continuous development integration point, at like the build servers? Where how do you enforce all these policies?
Optimally, you want them done at all stages. So you want to keep the amount of issues that you've got as visible across all stages, so everyone has visibility of everything. I think the easiest way is just before check-in of your code. And that way you kind of stop people checking in code if it doesn't adhere to your standards. And that will then work across different IDEs and everything, because you're, rather than, as you said, using a plugin or something that's very specific to you, it's done by the application itself, as in all of the configuration for the linting is within the application.
And what about setting it all up? I know we talked about this before, about, you know, what we're going to discuss on the podcast and things. You said it'd be interesting to talk about the setup of it and things. Do you have any kind of tools and platforms that you recommend for people looking to set it up?
Yeah, completely. So there's sort of three external libraries, packages, node modules, I guess you call them, that you'd use. So Husky is one, which is just an easy way to configure githooks. So githooks will be at whichever stage you want them. So at git add, git commit, git push. You can then run other tools. So I guess you use Husky to configure your githooks. And then within that, you can use two other tools. Lint staged is one that I've used recently, and that will run your linting against your staged files. So that's amazing. And then it will, so when you do your git add, it will say, we're just checking your files. And then it will say, your files are done, you know, move on to the next process. And that we use something called Pretty Quick, and that runs prettier behind the scenes on all your staged files just to get them into your format. So your linter will look at the code and its quality, and Prettier will run your formatting on that. So then you've got two ends of the spectrum. So I think ESLint will do formatting for you, but as a rule of thumb, everyone uses Prettier for that nowadays. So you can sort of get the best of both worlds and use the tools that are right for the job at each stage.
Yeah, that's really it. I must admit, I've never used githooks before, because it's either one of those where I suppose it's already set up. I will have experienced them in previous companies. I've had enforced message lengths and things like this. So yeah, you will see them, but I've never personally kind of used them or set them up, certainly not for ESLinting or linting purposes. So that's really interesting. I'm definitely going to go and check out Husky. I like the fact that with Prettier, you can take some of the energy out for devs, where if it goes, well, this isn't quite in the right format, I'm going to do it for you, which is nice, because you get the end result you want without actually having to put extra burden on devs, because we're not generally an energetic bunch. So if we have to go and do extra things, anything that takes that away from us, or that we can automate to the robot, then great. Well, I mean, that's dev life, isn't it? We could easily spend a day writing something to automate a process that takes 10 minutes.
I always find it afterwards, once you've got that in place and then you're doing comparisons between sort of history of the file, you then don't have that sort of formatting, the spacing, all of that getting in your way from seeing the changes. You can see exactly what was done and probably why, without having to sort of sift through noise to get to what you're looking for.
I'm not going to lie to you, I have no more questions about linting. I think I'm completely linted out. Is there anything you want to mention in your wealth of LinkedIn experience?
I guess to give it a try. I think most people will have a plugin that will run stuff behind the scenes, but it's never enforced. And, you know, everyone wants to write good code. They want to keep up to date with the latest and greatest. They want to follow best practices. I think it's an easy way to do so, because these rules get updated when new things come in. If you're using it, you'll always be up to date. You'll always be following best practices. And I think that's what all developers want. I think we always want to do what's best. So use something to do it for you, because we can't remember everything ourselves.
No, and I think you're right. We all want to be, or you should want to be, the best version or best developer version of yourself. And I think, you know, you might be an amazing coder. I might be an amazing coder, but what the code we write is very different. And I think getting that unified, exemplary code is what it's all about, and working to a set of kind of, you know, mutually agreed standards of the best version of our code. So no, I like that. thank you for coming and talking to us about LinkedIn. You know, I hope that because we're awesome, we can make these relatively dry topics a little bit more interesting. But it's good to get the pros and cons of things like LinkedIn and policies like that around that, why it's so important. Do you have anything that you'd like to, plug? A website, a weird band that you're in? I don't know. Do you make homebrew that you sell? I don't know. Whatever you'd like to plug.
Just my sort of Twitter handle. So at Design Puddle, I post a lot of stuff on everything sort of dev related. So if you're interested in following me, that would be great.
Definitely. I think he's, I follow Chris. He's well worth, hence he's on this show. He's well worth a follow. And if you'd like to talk to Chris about LinkedIn, anything dev related, or maybe not dev related, just talk to him in general, then yeah, you can find him on Twitter at Design Puddle. I'll put some links to the tools and policy and things that Chris mentioned, like Husky and Prettier. I think eventually I'm certainly going to badge you about writing a blog post on all this, because it'd be quite nice to have a walkthrough and how to set up things with GitHooks. So I'll keep poking you about that. And if you get that written, then I'll add that to the show notes as well.
Yeah, it's a great idea. I'll definitely think about that.
The collective pressure of people sat there waiting for this article. We want him to write this, write the LinkedIn article, Chris. The collective internet pressure. I love it. Well, thank you very much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's goodbye from me, and we shall catch you later, Chris.
Lovely. Cheers, Rob. Thanks.
So that's it for this episode. Do consider subscribing and give us a like or a share on social media. Speaking of which, if you'd like to follow the show, we're available on Twitter at Frontend Podcast. You can follow me, Rob Kendall, on Twitter too, at Kendall Mint Code. If you'd like to find out more about the show, sponsor an episode, or be a guest, you can find out more on the dedicated website, thefrontendpodcast.site.